Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Monday, March 16th. I'm Ray Graff. Support comes from Saratoga Hospital, expanding urgent care in the North Country with walk-in lab and imaging services at Saratoga Hospital, Adirondack Urgent Care in Queensbury, urgentcareadirondack.org. Joining us this afternoon is Dr. Eric Yeager of the Albany College of Pharmacy and Health Sciences. He is here to answer your questions about the coronavirus and microbiology as a whole. We anticipate a lot of calls, so get in early. 800-348-2551 is the number, 1-800-348-2551. You can also email us if you wish. Make them fairly brief emails. It's going to be a busy show. Dr. Eric Yeager, your calls coming up on Vox Pop right after the news. Hello once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Joining us today is Dr. Eric Yeager of the Albany College of Pharmacy and Health Sciences. Dr. Yeager has a PhD in biomedical sciences from the University at Albany. He teaches virology, biology, microbiology, and genetics at the Albany College of Pharmacy and Health Sciences. Dr. Yeager's research focuses on alterations in the immune system that make the elderly more susceptible to disease. He explores the impact of aging on immunity, which feels very relevant right about now with the coronavirus epidemic, as we may have been told that it affects the elderly more than the young. Dr. Yeager, it's great to have you here at this time. It's just fantastic. Thank you for coming on short notice.
Happy to join you today, Ray.
Our number is 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. You can also email us at voxpop@wamc.org, but the number is 800-348-2551. All right, before we get to the calls, and people are champing at the bit right now to talk, you know, there's the trepidation, the jitters throughout the nation. And before we get to the 101 level course on what a virus is and how it works, is the level of nervousness justified?
It is interesting. It's a virus we haven't seen before that the large population is naive against. So there's kind of a middle ground between concern versus panic. So it's definitely something to be concerned about. And we're learning more about this virus and how it spreads each day. But the level of panic is kind of the extreme.
Yeah.
My family members and friends, you know, vigilance, but not panic, because panic does not help. Fear right now is more contagious than the virus, I think.
You know, you see people, and we have a bottle right here with the antibacterial hand sanitizer. You see people doing this all the time. And I always thought a virus is not a bacteria. Does that do anything when you're protecting yourself against a virus? Let's talk about what a virus is and how it differs from an infection from a bacteria.
Sure. So we have two types of microbes here we discuss, so bacteria and viruses. So bacteria probably you're familiar with, like E. coli, they hear with like food poisoning, salmonella, food poisoning. A virus, what makes it different really is it's not some people call it a living organism, some people kind of in between.
Yeah.
So it needs to infect our cells. It needs our machinery to replicate, to survive, to leave and infect the next host, where bacteria contain all the machinery and blueprints to replicate themselves without assistance. So when we think about how to treat these two different pathogens, there's different levels of control, different levels of medications that work. So for bacteria, we have antibiotics that work specifically against the bacteria. With viruses, it's a little bit more challenging because they do use our own machinery, a little more challenging to find a substance that'll affect the virus and not our host cells.
Mm.
So something like this, the hand sanitizer you pointed to, so what it does is it disrupts the outer surface of a bacteria or a virus and makes it a little less able to survive in the environment. So it doesn't matter if it's necessarily a bacteria or a virus. What it's going to do with the virus and one focus today, the coronavirus, is disrupting its envelope. So if you disrupt the envelope, it makes the virus less infectious.
And how does a virus come into being? First of all, if it's a quasi-living thing, I've always wondered how these things came to be when they're neither live nor dead.
Right. It's a fascinating question that people have kind of tried to tackle, evolutionary biologists, virologists. So they somehow came out of that primordial soup, if you will, that they either contain DNA or RNA as their genetic material and how that gave rise to potentially cells. It's a fascinating story, and no one's really entirely sure where that kind of ancestral virus is. So it's still an active area of research.
All right, before we get to the calls, 800-348-2551, a couple of things. We hear from all the experts. Maintain your distance of at least 6 feet from others. Why do we do that, and why is 6 feet important?
So I believe 6 feet is chosen because of how the virus is spread. It's spread primarily through respiratory droplets. So people have probably seen on the news some reports about how long the virus can live on surfaces and the importance of disinfection. But scientists and epidemiologists and clinicians still believe that the virus is primarily spread through respiratory droplets. So by maintaining a certain level of distance, you know, more so than like yards away, you can still engage in social contact, but still hopefully leave some level of protection against you and someone that might be carrying the virus.
Well, we're close to 6 feet away.
Yeah.
So we'll be all right.
I feel completely safe.
Oh, good. Very good. I'm glad to hear that. And then, of course, we see the governor of New York and Connecticut and New Jersey say no more than 50 people in any grouping at any time. Why is that a significant number?
Good question. Expertise more in viruses and epidemiology, but I think it's a number that's chosen to, again, limit the spread. So what's been very important, people may have heard about social distancing, and you might have heard the term flattening the curve.
Yeah.
So what we're trying to do is, because testing has been slow to roll out, we're really trying to get ahead of things, and we're kind of flying blindly countrywide. So the idea here is if we can limit the spread of the virus, then we can flatten the curve. So if we are going to have a certain number of cases anyway, if we can spread those out so our healthcare systems don't get burdened. So I think that's why we see this level of drastic measures, is that really we're trying to limit the impact as much as we can. Now, it's greatly a lot of social disruption, of course, but really the idea here is we want to make sure that our hospitals can handle the cases if they and when they come in.
Governor Cuomo talked yesterday of a wave. It's going to be a wave either way.
Right.
Dr. Yeager is here. Dr. Eric Yeager of Albany College of Pharmacy and Health Sciences. Today, the news broke that the folks at Kaiser Permanente in Washington have unveiled the first stage study of a potential COVID-19 vaccine. How does a viral vaccine work?
Great question. So there's a number of candidates that are being tested. You've probably seen a number of those in the news, as you mentioned, that current study. So the idea is, can we get the body to respond to the virus and mount an immune response against it to protect us without causing the symptoms of disease?
Right.
So you can get immunity two different ways. Naturally, so if you're exposed to the virus, and again, importantly, 80% of the people that get exposed will have very mild symptoms, and those people will be left immune. So they'll be protected against subsequent exposures. But the idea between a vaccine is that, can we give someone that same level of protection without the risk of damage to the body?
Right.
So the idea with these different vaccines is, can we take a piece of the virus? Can we weaken the virus, give it to someone? And I should stress that vaccines generally take a long time to prepare. So normal vaccines can take decades to make, many years to ensure the safety. So we're kind of up against this need to have a vaccine because of the public pressure and because of the urgency of this virus, but still kind of maintain, we want to make sure the vaccines are tested, how they've been tested naturally throughout scientific methods.
And as this news points out, this is only stage one. It's still 12 to 18 months away,
right,
if all goes well.
Correct. So the first is to ensure that it's safe to use, and then the next is to ensure that it actually can elicit immunity, so the person is actually protected against the disease in question.
You know, I got an immunization when I was at my last doctor's appointment. I forget what it was for. Maybe it was just for the flu.
Yeah.
And it said, okay, you're going to be fine. We use broken bits of the virus and not active. How does a broken bit of a virus help you in any way?
Sure. So our body's responding to things that are foreign, and the foreign pieces on viruses, including the coronavirus we're dealing with, are the outer pieces of that virus. So if you kind of think of the coronavirus looks like a crown, if you will.
Yep.
So those pieces of the crown are what it uses to attach to our host cells. In particular, it uses a receptor called the ACE2 receptor. So that's why this virus is particular for certain human cells, particular for humans. So we know enough about viruses that if we can isolate the pieces that our body makes a response to, we can put those into our bodies that are still seen as foreign, and our body makes a response against those. Occasionally, it can work quite well, and the body makes a very good response. Other times, we kind of have to give booster shots or add something else to the vaccine. And as you mentioned, my research on the elderly, what's challenging is that the vaccines don't always work well for all populations. So it might work well for younger individuals, but as you age, your immune system becomes a little less vigorous. So we may have to have different approaches. So that's another thing to add to the equation as we develop vaccines, is this platform going to be effective for a whole population or a subset of the population.
Yeah, we've heard so much information, so much of it I'm sure that we'll find out has been incorrect or partially incorrect. But one of the first things we heard was, well, this really doesn't affect the young. This coronavirus is pretty much sparing the young. If that's true, and I have no idea if it is true, why?
That's a great question. I read some papers this morning. So it's believed that children may get exposed. They just may not have symptoms. So they still might be able to transmit the virus. So again, we're kind of in a new territory of a new virus. A lot we don't know. But it does appear that the older individuals appear to get sick because of a lot of the underlying health conditions. So it could be things like hypertension, diabetes, other respiratory illnesses. And there are some conditions that actually the receptor for the virus is increased levels in individuals of certain diseases that might make them more predisposed to infection and more severe disease.
We are joined today by Dr. Eric Yeager of Albany College of Pharmacy and Health Sciences. We'll take a quick break and then we'll get to the phones. 800-348-2551 is the number. Vox Pop on WAMC. Ray Graff with you. 800-348-2551 is the number. Dr. Eric Yeager of Albany College of Pharmacy and Health Sciences is here today. We talk coronavirus and microbiology in general. And, you know, before we start the calls, just want to let you know that even though this is Medical Monday, Dr. Yeager is not here to diagnose you. And I understand everybody's jitter. Anytime you feel any symptom of a cold, and it's cold and flu season, the first reaction is, oh, my God, I got corona.
Right.
And I sympathize with you at home on that. But Dr. Yeager is not here to diagnose you, but we'll talk about the virus and how it spread and things like that.
Happy to.
You ready for calls?
I'm ready.
Let's do this thing.
All right.
David in Little Falls, you're on.
Hello, Dr. Yeager. Thank you for answering my call. My question is, how soon is somebody able to spread the virus after they contact or someone else who has it?
That's a great question. Yeah. Do we know the answer to that?
I saw a paper this morning that it seems like 5 days. So the incubation period is defined as the time from when you're exposed to show symptoms appears to be 5 days. So typically it seems that someone becomes infectious as soon as they start showing symptoms. Mm. So it looks like 5 days, which is good because the 14-day quarantine you hear a lot about in the news is within that 5-day time frame. So it's thought that we're capturing a large number of people that could be infectious at that time.
Would they be able to identify that someone is in fact infected before 5 days with the current test?
That's a great question. I think that's still something that's being worked out, is how soon can you detect the virus? The test you're using is a molecular-based test. So the virus is what's called a RNA virus. And the testing that's done is actually a test very similar to how the flu virus is tested for. They take a swab, they stick it deep into the nose where the virus likes to reside.
Nice.
And then, yeah, I hear it's very uncomfortable.
Yeah.
They do this test, and it's a very sensitive test, and it can determine whether it's the flu virus or the coronavirus. And it's a very sensitive test, so theoretically, if there was one copy of the virus, they could detect it. I think right now they're looking for, basically because of this lack of tests, they're looking for people that are showing symptoms to confirm definitively that they have coronavirus, not the common cold or the flu virus.
David, thanks a lot for the call. And in talking before the program, we were talking about developing immunity if you have this. 80% of people who get this show little or no symptoms. And at that point then, in your past history of looking at these viruses, you have a level of immunity at that point?
It does appear that way, that this is, even though we think of this virus as this a large fear that we have, it's a virus like any other virus that the body's going to respond against. So you'll be infected by the virus, your body responds against it. And I should tell everyone, your immune system is built for this. It's built to fight off different viruses. And the way that works is, after a few days, you develop, like a week to 14 days, you develop antibodies and T cells. You probably hear about antibodies of vaccines. But once those develop, you are protected, and it seems like, with looking at other coronaviruses, protection It lasts anywhere from 5 to 10 years. And that's something that will still be looked at, is how long is that immunity going to last?
Why can't then we take the antibodies and T cells from someone who's already had this and develop a quicker vaccine?
Right. That's a great question. So the antibodies, there have been other infections where you can take the antibodies from someone that's been infected and they've survived. So they call this convalescent serum. So those antibodies theoretically could be protective. So there are some, like for the Ebola outbreak, for example, that was tried, where if you took serum from people that have been survive the infection, give it to someone else, that might afford them some level of protection. The trouble there is it's very challenging to do and you need a lot of it.
Ah, okay.
If you recall that movie Outbreak, I don't know if anyone recalled that movie Outbreak, but they had to capture that one monkey
yeah.
to cure
Thanks
the world.
Thanks for bringing that up at yeah, this sorry. Time. I appreciate it very
but
much.
But just to kind of highlight the misinformation. So it's something that it could be done, but it's very challenging to do. But the antibodies are helpful. So as we get people that have cleared the infection that are healthy again, we can take a look and see what their body is responding against and kind of model an antibody therapy or a vaccine against that.
Dr. Eric Yeager of Albany College of Pharmacy and Health Sciences is our guest. The number is 800-348-2551. Mark in Salem is next. Mark, you're on.
Hi, Ray.
Hi.
I'm going to tie two things together that are completely opposite, and then I'm going to ask a question.
Okay.
There's a constellation Bob Bergman would know. It's called Corona Borealis. because it's shaped like a crown. Does the virus actually have that shape? But my question is, how can you determine if you have, like if you've had the flu vaccine and you get mildly ill and you think, well, I'm just having a mild case of flu. Mm-hmm. How can you tell that from the coronavirus?
Okay. Fair enough.
Yeah, thanks, Mark. So so definitely it has that shape. So the name coronavirus comes from when scientists were able to see the virus, and they need a special microscope to do that. They're very small, as you can imagine. It does look to have like a crown around its outside surface. And in terms of distinguishing the different types of infections, so first off, if you receive the flu vaccine, it's a completely different virus. You are not protected against the current coronavirus by using this flu. So it's kind of a misnomer to call it another flu virus. It's a completely different virus.
It's more like a cold virus.
Correct. Yep. There are seven coronaviruses known to infect humans. Most cause a common cold, and the three that are causing more severe disease are the SARS virus, the MERS, and the current COVID-19 or SARS-CoV-2 virus. In terms of the symptoms, as we get more cases and scientists can do these tests, they have seen differences. So, for example, the common cold typically is sneezing, coughing, stuffy nose, and a sore throat. Whereas the flu, you'll get the fever, aches, chills, fatigue, cough, and a headache. But for the SARS-CoV-2 virus, the COVID-19 virus, it seems like fever is one of the biggest first symptoms. So fever, a dry cough, and shortness of breath.
Hmm.
Now, it's not to say if you've experienced some of the symptoms of flu, I mean, it's still worth getting tested for either, particularly if you find yourself in a vulnerable population. So if you're over the age of 60, definitely if you're over the age of 80. If you have some underlying health conditions, again, I'm not a doctor. These are CDC
exactly.
guidelines.
Yes.
But it does seem like there are differences in the initial presentations of the infections.
Mark, thank you very much for the call. Now, you mentioned there are seven viruses in the corona family.
That infect humans, correct.
Tell me about this family tree. Which was first? And who was the daddy virus?
Good question. Were there mutations?
What I've
studied is, so the beta coronaviruses are the ones that seem to infect humans. There are other viruses that infect mammals and cause problems, like in pigs, for example. So there's a somewhat fascinating story in that these viruses originate from bats. So they reside in bats, and that's why China is thought to have been kind of the epicenter, is that there are bat colonies very close to animals that carry these viruses back to people. So the coronavirus is what's called a zoonotic disease. So it spread from an animal out in the wild to people. And there was initially some concern that maybe this virus was kind of a bioweapon or it was something in the lab. But when they've done some more testing, what they've realized is the genetic sequence of this virus and what they found in bats is very similar. So it was definitely a virus that exists in nature. It was kind of ready to go, and it just needed to, unfortunately, encounter people. So really, this is not something that, you know, is this new weapon. What it really was is it took a change in ecology. So people get becoming kind of encroaching into bat habitats or different habitats, farming practices, global travel, a larger population of people that are older or immunocompromised that leads to these kind of viruses affecting people.
Dr. Eric Yeager is our guest today. The number is 800-348-2551. Jim in Matamoros. Jim, you're on.
since a virus is considered a particle between the living and the dead, and some viruses can undergo a process similar to bacterial sporulation and become dormant, how can a product be labeled viricidal rather than viral inactivator?
Okay, thanks, Jim.
Yeah, Jim, good question. It's so really with viruses, they are kind of that not living, not dead. So they definitely need host cell machinery. Now, there's some, like, I think, kind of a sporulation idea is, can they survive long-term on surfaces? And they've done some studies with this virus and other viruses. Because always important is, how often should you disinfect? And a recent study came out that suggests that these viruses can maybe survive, you know, a few hours on certain surfaces or a certain day, maybe 2 to 3 days on stainless steel and cardboard.
Mm-hmm.
That's under laboratory conditions. So real world with UV light, humidity, things like that can change it. So when we look at things that are considered antiviral, what you're looking for is a substance that prevents the ability of the virus to infect a host cell. So with an antimicrobial compound, sometimes it's preventing the bacteria from replicating itself or actually killing the microbe. Mm. With viruses, you're looking to disrupt its ability to infect.
All right, Jim, thanks a lot for the call. We appreciate it. Our number here is 800-348-2551. And let's go to Eileen in Kingston. Hello, Eileen.
Oh, hello there. I have a couple of questions. One is that I read yesterday that in order to flatten the curve, 20-plus weeks would be a more realistic time frame. I'm wondering if you think that will be in our future soon. And I also have a question about supermarket employees and how they can be protected, and if you think that working in a supermarket is high risk for those employees. Would you suggest masks for the employees? I know there's a shortage of N95, and not even all medical personnel can have them because there's such a huge shortage, but maybe we can make more and then give them to supermarket employees. Would you limit the number of people going into the store? And also, what do you think of the idea that people want employees to work 12-hour shifts? Should they be shortened to 8?
All right. There's a lot to unpack there, Eileen. Doctor, do you remember the beginning of that question?
I do. So the time frame for flattening that curve, I think, again, not being an epidemiologist, but I think a lot, my own opinion is that we don't yet have enough information on how long it's going to take. We don't know how many people have been exposed and have not showing symptoms. So we just don't know where we're at in that curve. And I think that's why you see the level of kind of drastic measures being taken, because we don't want to get to the point where we're on that peak and it's too late to turn back. In terms of populations at risk, I mean, certainly in a supermarket, you're in contact with a lot of people. So I think definitely, as the CDC is prescribed, to definitely hand wash as often as possible if you feel ill, to avoid contact with people. I know it's not always possible to control people coming into the store if they're ill or not.
Right.
In terms of masks, it's definitely something that's been discouraged by the Centers for Disease Control, and I believe New York State Department of Health, for a couple of reasons. So first, primarily, the masks are definitely needed for our medical personnel. We don't want to deplete the stocks of even hand sanitizer, masks, and things like that.
Yeah.
More importantly, the masks that you kind of see a lot on TV, like those white masks.
Yeah.
Those are more for people that are sick. They're not going to prevent the respiratory droplets from coming into you. They're more to prevent the droplets from leaving.
Ah.
So they're more for when you're sick. The N95 mask the caller has mentioned, and I've kind of gone through this when I worked at, doing some research, it's meant those masks definitely do protect you, but they're not something you can just buy off the shelf and use. You have to be what's called fit tested to make sure that they are the right size for your mouth. Ray and I are both bearded. That's something you'd want to remove, of course.
Right,
so that
of course
also prevents the mask from working effectively. And they're also something that really again, wearing those in the past, they're not very comfortable. It slows your breathing a little bit, so they're not the best things to wear. So, I mean, it's something that maybe at-risk populations a physician may prescribe, but you definitely want to keep those more for our medical personnel. Our frontline individuals are going to definitely be at risk for being exposed to the virus.
All right, Eileen, thanks a lot for the call. The number here is 800-348-2551. We also hear that, oh, gosh, don't pay with cash, don't get any change at the store. Is there some wisdom in that?
I think it's kind of the unknown. It's just how long can the virus persist on different materials?
Yeah, there's a lot of information
out there. Yeah, and we're learning, and I think that's, you know, as we talked before, is just you want to be informed, but it can get a little overwhelming at times. So it's important to first is find the right sources. So like Department of Health website, CDC, and also probably give yourself unplug a little bit sometimes.
You've been around the viral block a few times. How nervous are you right now?
I'm vigilant, just kind of watching to see the number of cases, the number of tests that are done locally. I'm not certainly kind of duct taping my doors and windows and locking myself inside. You know, definitely being more cautious. I think really what it's more for is like during these times, you kind of worry about yourself, but it's more of the community worry.
Yeah.
And kind of, you know, being kind, being compassionate, and worrying more about those vulnerable populations. So I think someone of my age and level of health, if I were to get sick, I would say I'm probably going to be fine.
Yeah.
But if I were to spread the virus to my 91-year-old grandmother, that's my concern. So really my level of concern is making sure I don't spread the virus to more vulnerable populations.
Our guest today is Dr. Eric Yeager of Albany College of Pharmacy and Health Sciences. We now go to Chuck in Latham. Chuck, you're on.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
So my question is kind of about how some of the European countries that have been dealing with this for a little bit longer have somewhat of a head start on some issues they've been experiencing. One in particular is that, it's now like the French and Italian governments are saying that, you know, don't use ibuprofen for fever management because it's an anti-inflammatory, and that's showing people to have like dramatically worse conditions. But that hasn't quite made it to the CDC's recommendations yet. So I was wondering if you could speak to that.
That's another thing you see on social media, and I've seen that as well.
Yeah, there's a lot of things that, you know, clinicians are trying to see. There's been some different testing of different drugs that might work, especially early on in the outbreak in China. They tried a variety of different antivirals to see what would work. And in the report that just came out about ibuprofen, I read a paper this morning that suggests what ibuprofen might do is increase the level of the ACE2 receptor on cells, so it might make people more susceptible. So something to kind of consider, but I think what's probably happening is that the CDC and other professionals are looking at that to make sure that's something to roll out nationally. I think that's want to make sure it's legit.
But that's a very – and thank you for the call, Chuck, but that's a very tough situation.
Yeah.
Now, you have a family member who's got 103 and you want to knock that fever down. Then what do you do?
Right. So I think other non-ibuprofen medications are still – they seem to be okay.
All right. Let's go back to the phones at 800-348-2551. And Penny in Del Mar. Penny, you're on.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. I heard that if you swab the interior of your nostrils, like with Neosporin, that would prevent the bacteria from penetrating.
So, Penny, so some of the materials like Neosporin are antibacterial. So it may, first, I don't know if it's the indication to use it inside the body like that. So I don't think it's, you know, recommended to put things inside your nose. I don't think it's been shown that it has any effect on a virus or any virus just yet. The thing that's working primarily to show the best efficacy is hand washing.
Yep.
Hand washing, coughing into coughing or sneezing into your elbow like a vampire, if you will.
Yeah.
We have signs everywhere.
Right.
And just being vigilant. Something like Neosporin, I know in some cases, like for surgeries, they might give some antibiotics that way, but that's something that I, in my own opinion, is probably not going to impact the viral infection.
All right, Penny, thanks a lot for the call. Boy, just the concept of putting Neosporin in your nose. Oh, man, I don't know. All right, let's go now to Mike. Mike in Albany, you're up.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. I'm just calling to kind of follow up on the idea of immunocompromised people. Like, would someone who had, say, something like multiple sclerosis be more susceptible? And a follow-up to that, would any of the medications that, like, affect the immune system to deal with multiple sclerosis also and or not at all make someone more susceptible?
Right. Thanks, Mike, for your question. So for people out there, MS being an autoimmune disease where your body's attacking itself,
yep.
I imagine some of the therapies given kind of have an anti-immune function. Those individuals are likely considered, you know, they're not part of that CDC classification yet. Mainly it's people that have hypertension, diabetes, lung respiratory problems.
Mm-hmm.
But I think any level of caution is warranted. So if you, under normal conditions for other infections or bacterial infections on a yearly basis, this is no different. So follow the same practices and maybe avoid going out.
All right, Mike, thanks a lot for the call. Before we take our next break, you had mentioned earlier that there was some speculation very early on that this coronavirus, this new coronavirus, could have been manufactured somehow in a biological weapons lab.
Right.
Is that something that actually happens? And how do you make a virus?
Right. How do you make a virus? It's surprisingly the blueprint. So the virus that's causing this outbreak, they had the blueprint of that virus very soon. So it's very easy to isolate material from the virus and just see what those letters that make up its blueprint are. Could you make a virus? There was some concern back with the 1918 pandemic. They were able to isolate material from that 1918 virus, and they could replicate it in a laboratory setting to study it.
This is the Spanish flu?
Yeah, correct. What was called the Spanish flu at the time. So viruses can be, made per se. So, the idea that a virus was made is not completely outlandish. But for this virus, the data strongly, strongly suggests that it occurred naturally in bats, and it spread from bats to some intermediary. Perhaps in the markets in China, and then it's jumped from the animals to people.
I have so many questions about the level of detective work it takes to figure out this chain.
Right.
But I think that would take another show. So let's just take a break.
Okay.
800-348-2551 is our number. Dr. Eric Yeager is here. We'll be back. Welcome back to Vox Pop. Ray Graff here. Number is 800-348-2551. We talked to Dr. Eric Yeager today of Albany College of Pharmacy and Health Sciences, and it's all about coronavirus today. A few emails here, doctor, and then back to the phones.
All right.
This one's from Jennifer, and the subject heading is coronavirus testing. For those of us who may have had coronavirus but were not tested due to the shortage of tests, will there ever be a way to know if we had it?
Great question. So the test that's done now, as I mentioned, is a molecular test that's looking for the presence of typically an active infection. So it's a virus in your body replicating. Once your body makes an immune response to the virus, it leaves like a fingerprint, if you will. So there are tests that can be done serologically so they could draw some blood to show if you were exposed at a certain point. It's not as, they can't say exactly when, like a timestamp, but they can say yes or no, have you been exposed?
Yeah. This one is from David in Italy. And our thoughts are with you there,
definitely,
my friend. David writes, I have read that an antibody therapy could be a faster way to act against the virus rather than waiting for a vaccine, which might take up to 18 months. Why can't we focus on this? And you and I talked about this a little
bit. So the antibody therapy, yes, it would be something that if we could identify what part of the virus to target and show that it's effective in experimental studies first. There are companies, even locally, that work to generate products that are antibody-based as a drug.
Right.
Because you're right, if a vaccine has to go through testing, and then giving the vaccine, it's going to take someone time to develop their own antibodies. So a therapeutic that's based on an antibody is something that's attractive and is being currently researched.
This one is from Berger. Berger writes, in aid of maintaining vigilance instead of panic, would it make sense for us to start taking our own temperatures daily now to establish our own normal baseline so that we'll be able to see significant increase if and when it happens? Is once a day enough, say immediately upon awakening before you get up and start your day's activities, or would more often be better?
It's a great question. I think it's kind of on a person-by-person basis, but I would say I'm someone that has a fitness watch. And when I first got it, I found myself looking at it every single day. How many steps did I do? So yeah. You kind of get to the sense of anxiety and stress over, did I get enough steps in? And I think that's going to drive maybe some level of anxiety in someone if you're taking your temperature each day. Oh, it went up 0.1 degree.
Yeah.
I took it a few hours after than I normally take, and it's down a few degrees. So I think it can lead to some level of panic and of just what's going to happen. So I think really it's just, it's not harmful to check it, but don't become, too religious about it. I think it's going to drive you to probably be a little bit more anxious than you need to be.
All right, let me ask you a question. If you don't have one of those temporal thermometers
that
they're using now at the White House, even when reporters come in, and you have the old-fashioned, not necessarily the old-fashioned mercury thermometer,
sure,
but the electronic thermometer you put in your mouth, what's the best way to clean that thing for the next time?
Good question. I think for that, I would probably recommend there are some antiseptic wipes you can use.
Can't get them now.
Can't get them now. No. I think the one thing you can make is you can make your own solution of bleach, and it's a third cup to a gallon of water. There's some guidelines on the CDC website to make smaller amounts if you don't need a gallon.
Fair enough.
But that seems to be effective. It's been shown to be effective against the virus. So you could kind of you know, wipe the thermometer with that, let it air dry.
Okay.
So with these materials, it's really what is proven effective against the virus, and contact time is important too.
Right.
But 10% bleach seems to be good.
Okay. This one is from Mike, and then we'll get back to the phone call.
Sure.
Mike in Richmond says, could the doctor please comment on whether or not it would be better to get infected early in the ramp up before hospitals become overwhelmed, or keep trying to avoid infection altogether, which may be a futile goal? Again, this is not really your specialty, but it's a good question.
It's a good question. I think, importantly, not to get sick if possible. I don't think timing is – I think definitely if things peak and there's a run on hospital beds and respirators, again, we're in rough shape.
Yeah.
But I think definitely taking precautions not to be sick. That's what I would recommend.
Have you in your life – and I'm older than
sure.
you, and I have not seen it – but in your professional life, have you seen an international level of anxiety like this before?
The only things that I think come close would be maybe the SARS epidemic of 2002 to 2003, and then maybe the 2009 swine flu.
Now, why were those two? That was H1N1, right?
Correct, H1N1.
Now, why were those two also scary?
Great. So I think they were scary because they kind of caused a large number of, you know, infections and in some cases fatalities kind of quickly. And it seemed to be a virus that we had not anticipated is not maybe the word I should use, but we didn't expect to kind of rise. So if the SARS virus kind of rose up out of China and then spread into Toronto and Canada, and then for the H1N1 novel swine virus in 2009 kind of popped up in parts of Mexico and in Texas.
Yeah.
So it was more just kind of the appearance of this virus that seemed different and theoretically our body was not ready to respond against.
And very similar then to what's happening now.
Right. And the SARS outbreak is interesting because this current virus is basically, you can kind of think of it as a cousin of the SARS virus.
Mm.
So there's been some papers I read the past couple of days as why did that initial SARS virus just peter out? Why isn't it like what we're seeing today? And there does seem to be differences in transmissibility. So that SARS virus didn't transmit as readily as the current virus. And the fatality rate for that virus was much higher. So I think it was around 10%. So when people get ambulatory, that's less able for them to spread the virus from person to person.
Because viruses are not strictly speaking alive, can mm-hmm. they sort of be a product of natural selection?
No, that's a great question. There are some historical references to having certain genetic characteristics. So it could be polymorphisms in the receptor the virus binds to. And there's even been some selection events. So, for example, the smallpox outbreaks were thought to select for a certain receptor that maybe allow people to be resistant to HIV. So it's a very fascinating story for maybe another show. But there is some evidence that viruses drive evolution.
I'll tell you what, you're coming back. If you'll come back, you're coming back. Dr. Eric Yeager is our guest from Albany College of Pharmacy and Health Sciences. Let's jump back to the phones. Susan in Southampton. Susan, you're on.
Yes, hi. Is this a good time or not to get the pneumonia shot?
So I would say, Susan, any time is a good time if you are a population that has risk for pneumonia and you normally get that shot. So it's a shot typically given to people that are, you know, over the age of 65. Getting mm-hmm. the shot is not going to impact your immune response to the coronavirus. There are still other things out there. Flu is still prevalent. Pneumonia could still be prevalent. So I would definitely recommend to continue with, again, not being a doctor, but being an immunologist and kind of an expert on some viruses. Definitely stay with your vaccines.
Okay. And since I'm not allowed to go to a casino for a long time, why is the pneumonia vaccine every year a crapshoot? Sometimes it's better. Sometimes it's not so good.
Well, for that one, I think maybe the flu vaccine is the one that kind of differs.
Oh, maybe that's
yeah,
it. Yeah,
so the
flu.
So the one difference between these two viruses that we're concerned about, and I should mention too, all the precautions people are taking to not get exposed to the coronavirus are going to work the same for flu. So
right.
hopefully we're protecting us doubly.
Yeah.
So for the flu virus, its outer surface can change quite rapidly. So it again, it's not a live virus. It's not kind of being insidious, but be a selection process in how it has its blueprint. If you think about the construction crew that follows that blueprint, they're not the best workers, so occasionally they make some mistakes. And those mistakes allow the virus to evade our immune responses and the vaccines we're making.
When they talk of a mutation, that is what they're speaking of?
Correct, yep. And that happens naturally. It sometimes happens in the process of the vaccine being produced. So there's not always a match. But even when it's not matched sufficiently, there's still a level of protection. And there's still a data out there to suggest that, you know, even a vaccine that might be 40% effective is better than no vaccine.
Yeah.
And in some cases, it can prevent you from experiencing, particularly vulnerable populations, from health issues that might be akin to the flu infection. So, for example, cardiovascular disease or other respiratory illnesses might be also impacted by a vaccine. That's an active area of research. Now, with the coronavirus, it does not appear to mutate like the flu virus. So the hope is that once the vaccine's developed, it may be a vaccine that protects against that coronavirus.
How do they know that?
Just on looking at other viruses, other coronaviruses they've studied. So a lot of it's based on, you know, we have this coronavirus that causes a common cold. There's some similarities in its structure to those proteins, and it doesn't seem to mutate as readily. This virus is also interesting. I watched a seminar last week on it. This one actually has a better construction crew, so it actually can repair its mutations. So that is good for the virus and also maybe good for us in that it's not going to mutate. We don't think mutate. So the idea is that if we can develop a vaccine, we can protect us against now this coronavirus. Now, unfortunately, it's not going to be a vaccine, it seems, that might be kind of a universal coronavirus vaccine.
In other words, a vaccine for the common cold.
Right, right. It would be a vaccine against this particular coronavirus.
Right about now, that'd be pretty good.
I agree.
And Dr. Eric Yeager is our guest. And back to the phones, MJ in Pittsfield. MJ, you're up.
Hi. I have a question about echinacea and zinc. I've heard a lot that that might help boost the immune system.
Good question, MJ. So there's been a lot of kind of anecdotal evidence and some studies that have begun to look at whether echinacea and zinc and some other therapies do boost the immune response. They have not been rigorously tested like an antiviral or a vaccine. So it's something that's been looked at, you know, and I'm certain that as we learn more about this virus, those will be tested as well.
Okay. And my second question is, should pharmacists be wearing masks and gloves or dispensing medication?
So dispensing medication, yes. There are still a lot of people that need medications every day on the hour for a variety of different diseases. So that has to continue. There are patients that need their, you know, insulin, patients that need HIV drugs. They need to get those drugs on a daily basis. And they are, unfortunately, a member, a health profession that is contacting people. So they have to be considerate of washing their hands, being ensure that, you know, if they see an ill patient, if they're ill themselves, to take the right precautions. Again, the masks is something that right now they're keeping the masks more for those kind of first responders. And I mentioned those N95 masks. So the white masks you might see, those are for individuals that are sick. It prevents them from spreading it to other people, not so much to prevent them from getting sick.
MJ, thanks a lot for the call. Over to Ed in Hillsdale. Ed, you're on.
Hi. Do polyester gloves provide any protection from surface viral material?
So great question about different materials that might provide protection. And all we have to go on right now is that current study that looked at the survivability of the virus on things like cardboard, on things like stainless steel. The thing they found most is, for some reason, the virus is not like copper. Not sure why. But I'm sure as we learn more about this virus, learning about how it can survive on different surfaces. Now, I should mention, for viruses that are enveloped, they typically they're a little bit more fragile. So things like the flu is also an envelope virus.
What does that mean exactly?
So if you compare it to the polio virus, for example, think of a virus as kind of like an M&M, if you will. Inside that M&M is its blueprint.
Yeah.
And that candy shell is the protein that encapsulates to protect it naturally. Mm-hmm. On that that surface is its receptors it uses to infect other cells. So some viruses just have that protein shell. Other viruses evolved to develop this envelope. Now, it's not an envelope like you see in the mail. It's an envelope made of lipids, for example, lipids that are found inside our own cells. And their proteins that need to get to other cells are found within those envelopes. And those envelopes need to be ordered in kind of packets, we call lipid rafts. So if you disrupt those rafts, the virus becomes less infectious. So envelope viruses tend to be a bit more fragile in the environment to humidity, to temperature change, to UV light, compared to naked viruses.
Very interesting. Ed, that's a great call. Thank you very much. And over to Middletown. Joe, you're up.
Yes, with all the advice we get about the personal methods we should all be adopting to fight the virus, don't touch and wash your hands, cover your mouth, why don't we hear the CDC and other agencies insist that medical workers not wear their work clothes out into the public? Now, you may not notice that in suburbia, but I have an apartment near a large world-class hospital, and our elevators in our apartment building and the coffee shops in the neighborhood are packed with people in scrubs. And long before this event, the American Medical Association, the College of Physicians, or the College of Surgeons, there's the Professional Nurses Association, have all called and done papers on saying you should not wear lab coats, scrubs, and other work attire into public just for staph infections and all kinds of other microbes. And now we have this. So why do those people get a pass on something so simple that they should be doing?
You pose a great question, Joe. Go ahead, Doc.
No, I agree. When I'm working with viruses in the laboratory, I mean, we follow safety precautions, gloves, masks if we need them, lab coats, and they stay within the lab.
Yeah.
So I can't really speak for why, you know, certain hospitals or professions are allowed to
leave. But you would advise against that?
I wouldn't be surprised if it changes.
All right, Joe, thanks a lot. Great one. And now we go to Goldie. Hello, Goldie in Akard. You're on.
Hi. I had several specific questions.
Oh, well, let's go with a couple, okay? A lot of callers. So just
okay, I have two things I'm interested in. Number one, is hydrogen peroxide effective against the coronavirus? And then also, hello?
Yes.
Hello.
Yes, Goldie,
oh, okay.
I believe
did
that.
Did you hear what I just said?
Yes. I believe that the CDC on their site does have peroxide as one of the disinfectants that will work against the virus. I can't recall offhand what the percentage is. It doesn't necessarily need to be like
I
just straight.
I think what you get in the store is a 3% solution.
I think it's at least that. But I wouldn't be surprised if that website, the CDC website, is a fantastic source. They have the exact recipes for a lot of those disinfectants. And they have a listing for store-bought, if you can find them, disinfectants that have been shown to work against this virus.
All right, Goldie, thank you very much. I'm sorry to move it along here, but there are so many people that we will not get to. Ben in Millbury, Vermont. Ben, you're on.
Hi. I have a question. They don't seem to know exactly how long the virus will stay on a hard surface. Can this virus be transmitted by an infected person handling mail through the mail, like through the post office,
right,
on hard surfaces?
Well, congratulations, Ben, for reaching my level of paranoia, sir. Well done.
No, it's something that people have thought about, and in that study that looked at the surfaces and how long the viruses live, those were under laboratory conditions. So
yeah.
The thought is, the virus might persist on envelopes, but you think about the temperature changes, it's exposed to light, it's exposed to all these different conditions, that the survivability on the virus on envelopes and in the normal mail is probably greatly reduced.
Theoretically possible, but.
Right.
Okay, Ben, good question. Thank you very much. And now quickly over to Rensselaer County. Wayne, you're on. Hello. Hello, Wayne. Wayne. Goodbye, Wayne. Sorry about that. We're running out of time here. Let's go to Danny. Danny and Troy, you're on. Oh, boy.
Hey, Ray.
Oh, hi.
Hey, Doc.
Hi, Danny. How you doing?
We got you.
How's our volume? Are we okay?
Yeah, you're all set. Right. You have about 30 seconds. Go ahead.
All right. I have this little home remedy that I take pretty regularly. It's garlic and ginger, and it's raw. I blend it up small because I'm convinced that one of or both of those are antiviral. They have antiviral properties. Is there any truth to that, or am I nuts?
No, you're not nuts. I think people have been looked at other food products and other homeopathic remedies. There just isn't peer-reviewed studies are what really are needed, where scientists compare it to show that it really does impact any virus, particularly this virus, and that's probably something that will be done in the future. But you definitely need a study that's peer-reviewed.
Right.
Now, with garlic, I mean, if you're using a lot, it probably keeps people away. So that has a side effect. So maybe, social distancing by
default.
Is
there a diet?
No, we're just about out of time, Danny, but that's it. I got to tell you something, Dr. Yeager.
Yeah.
I feel more relaxed now. I've been a little tense.
Well, I'm glad to hear it. That was my goal as a scientist. It's my job to, inform, dispel misinformation, and kind of calm, hopefully, a little bit. Like I said, more concern more than panic.
If this continues, and I got to say, this is probably going to continue, will you come back?
Yeah, I'm happy to schedule.
Great job, man. Thanks a lot. Support comes from the bariatric program at Adirondack Health, Saranac Lake, offering weight loss surgery and lifestyle education. Better health, better lives, AdirondackHealth.org. Once again, thanks to Dr. Eric Yeager of the Albany College of Pharmacy and Health Sciences for being here. Thank you for listening. I apologize to the many of you who didn't get your call in today. We'll get this guy back as soon as we can. Meantime, everybody, wash your hands and just take it easy. Maybe turn off the news for a couple minutes. Not WAMC, mind you, but you know what I'm saying. Relax, and everything will be okay, perhaps. Thanks to our engineer, Zach Malloy. Kayleen White answered the calls. Our producer is Jackie Orchard. I'm Ray Graff. Join us tomorrow for another exciting episode of Vox Pop that we don't know what it is, and I'm sure there'll be some press conferences. But right now, stand by for the Media Project.